Okay, so let's set the scene for a minute.
Let's do it.
It is May of 1964. You turn on your radio, and well, the world is just in the absolute grip of Beatlemania.
Completely taken over.
Right. I mean, the Fab Four have essentially colonized the American charts. They hold the top five spots. It feels like rock and roll has permanently evicted the old guard.
Yeah, nothing is ever gonna look back.
Exactly. But then, if you look at the Billboard Hot 100, something impossible happens. The Beatles get knocked off the number one spot.
And it wasn't by the Rolling Stones,
No.
and it wasn't Elvis Presley or, you know, the Beach
It was
Boys.
a 62-year-old jazz legend, Louis Armstrong.
Which is just wild.
The singing show tune. From a Broadway musical that at that specific moment hadn't even opened in New York yet.
It's just a staggering piece of cultural data when you really think about it. I mean, you have this counterculture revolution bubbling up, the British invasion is in full swing, and yet the biggest song in America is Hello, Dolly.
Hello, Dolly. Exactly. And that collision, that moment where the old world glamour sort of punches back against the new world grit, that brings us to the subject of our deep dive today.
Yeah, we are unpacking the life and the, well, the very specific genius of the man who wrote that song.
The composer and lyricist, Gerry Herman.
A man who, for better or worse, defined the golden age of the American musical in the public imagination. Like when
What?
people close their eyes and picture Broadway, the feathers, the descending staircases, the unashamed optimism, they are picturing Gerry Herman, even if they don't know his name.
He is the architect behind Hello, Dolly, Mamet, and La Cage aux Folles. But I want to be clear about our mission today for everyone
We
listening.
aren't just reading his resume.
Right now, we need to figure out how a guy who started as a camp counselor ended up quietly revolutionizing gay representation on stage, all while sticking to a very specific and honestly controversial artistic philosophy.
The philosophy of the simple, hummable show tune.
Yes. And simple is a loaded word, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
It can mean elegant, but it can also mean, dumb.
Precisely. And Herman spent his whole career fighting that distinction. What we're going to find in the source material we're looking at today is that simple doesn't mean easy, and optimistic doesn't mean shallow. In
Right.
fact, creating unironic joy might be the hardest engineering problem in the theater.
So let's go back to the blueprint, because you mentioned engineering, and that's actually not far off from his original path.
Yeah.
But he starts in Jersey City, 1931.
Born in Manhattan, but yeah, raised in Jersey City, only child of middle-class Jewish parents.
Harry and Ruth.
Right. And standard solid upbringing.
But every single biography, every source we looked at for this deep dive emphasizes the mother, Ruth Herman.
Oh, heavily.
It feels like you literally can't understand Jerry without understanding Ruth.
She is the alpha and the omega of his creative life.
Yeah.
She was a singer, a pianist, a teacher. She worked in the hotels. Herman famously said once that his mother was glamorous like Mamie and witty like Dolly.
Which is a lovely sentiment, but it also feels a bit, I don't know, singular. Like if he's basing these massive female icons on one person his mother does that limit the range of his
I
characters.
see what you mean.
Are Dolly Levi and Mamie Dennis just the same woman in different costumes?
That is a valid criticism, and it's one that theater critics used against him for decades. They argued he had a formula.
Right.
But the counter argument, and I think the stronger one from the materials, is that he wasn't trying to write a documentary about women. He was capturing a specific archetype of American
He
resilience.
was writing the woman who refuses to go down without a fight.
Who refuses to turn off the lights.
Exactly. That resilience was tested very early on for him.
It was. Ruth died of cancer in 1954. She was only 44 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. And Herman had just started his career. His first off-Broadway revue, called I Feel Wonderful, was the only show of his she ever saw.
That's heartbreaking. So when he writes these huge songs later, songs about rejoining the human race or
Yeah.
living, 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 he's essentially talking to a ghost.
In a lot of ways, yes, he's keeping her alive. When Dolly Levi talks to her late husband, Ephraim, in the show, asking for a sign to move on, that is Gerry Herman processing his own grief.
It adds a layer of poignancy that prevents the optimism from feeling cheap.
Yes. It's optimism earned through loss.
Now, before he gets to Broadway, there is this fascinating detour in his education that I didn't know about.
The design school.
Yeah, he didn't start in a music conservatory. He started at the Parsons School of Design,
He wanted to be an interior decorator.
which, looking at his shows, actually explains a whole lot.
How so? What's the connection for you there?
Well, think about a Gerry Herman song. It's not messy.
No.
It's structured like a perfectly decorated room, Everything is in its right place. There's no clutter. He's not like Stephen Sondheim, who leaves the wiring exposed so you can see the complexity.
Right, right.
Herman wants you to see the finished, beautiful facade.
That is a brilliant way to put it. He was decorating the world with melody. He valued symmetry, balance, and immediate appeal. But there was another training ground that was even more practical than Parsons.
The summer camp.
Stissing Lake Camp, up in the Taconic Mountains.
His parents ran it, right?
They did. And Herman spent every summer there from age 6 to 23. He eventually became the drama director. He was putting on productions of Oklahoma and Finian's Rainbow.
I feel like that is the best possible training for a commercial theater writer.
Absolutely.
You can't be obscure when your audience is a bunch of campers and their parents. You have to grab them.
Exactly. If you lose the audience's attention in a camp dining hall, you've lost them forever. It honed his instinct for the big finish. He learned that clarity is king. If the audience doesn't understand the melody instantly, cut it.
So he switches from design to theater. Mm-hmm. He transfers to the University of Miami, which had a great avant-garde drama department back then, and he just starts writing.
And he has that hitmaker gene right away.
Yeah, he writes a college show called Sketchbook that was scheduled for 3 performances, and it was so popular it ran for 20.
Which is unheard of for a college show.
So he makes his way to the big leagues. We hit the golden era, 1964, collaboration with Carol Channing and producer David Merrick.
Hello, Dolly.
And we talk about the song at the top of the deep dive, but the show itself, I mean, the stats are absurd.
It was a juggernaut. It won 10 Tony Awards. A record that stood unbroken for 37 years. It wasn't until the producers in 2001 that anyone beat it.
That's crazy.
And it ran for 2,844 performances. Longest running musical of its time.
And then 2 years later, he does MAME with Angela Lansbury. Another massive hit.
Producing huge standards like, we need a little Christmas. And if he walked into my life.
Which won Idie Gourmet a Grammy, by the way?
Right.
Okay, I want to pause here and dig into the mechanics.
Yeah.
Because we keep saying simple, hummable show tune.
Yeah.
But if it was easy to write a song that the whole world hums, everyone would do it.
Very true.
What was the Herman secret sauce? From a musical perspective, what is he actually doing?
It's all about the build. Herman was an architectural composer. He mastered the showstopper formula.
Okay, break that down for us.
Let's take the title song, Hello, Dolly. It starts intimate, almost conversational. Hello, Harry. Well, hello, Louis. It's inviting you in.
Low stakes friendly.
Right. Then he introduces the syncopation. The beat kicks in. The chorus joins. The energy ramps up. And then, and this is the absolute Herman signature, the modulation.
The key change.
The key change. He usually shifts the key up a half step for the final verse. It's a trick, sure, but it's a powerful psychological trigger. It signals to the audience that we have arrived at the climax.
The moment the hair on the back of your neck stands up.
Exactly. He also treated the vamp, that repeating musical loop, while the characters dance or walk down the stairs as a character in itself.
Oh, that's interesting.
He knew exactly how long to make the audience wait for the melody to come back. It's tension and release, engineered to perfection.
So he's basically manipulating our dopamine receptors with key changes and brass sections.
Unashamedly. While his contemporary, Stephen Sondheim, was deconstructing the musical writing complex songs about ambivalence, Herman was doubling down on the dopamine. Sondheim challenged you to think. Herman challenged you to smile.
But this philosophy had a ceiling, didn't it? Because the 60s ended, the world got darker, and Herman tried to keep the party going.
And that brings us to the flops.
Yeah.
He actually tried to go dark once with a show called Madame Aphrodite in 1961. Failed miserably, ran for 13 performances. He realized his lane was optimism.
But the most interesting failure is Mac and Mabel in 1974.
Yes.
This is the one that Broadway aficionados obsess over, starring Robert Preston and Bernadette Peters. Herman considered it his personal favorite score, so why did it bomb?
It really highlights the limitation of his optimism. The story is about the silent film era, Mack Sennett and Mabel Normand. But their real story is tragic.
Right.
It involves drug addiction, scandal, a tumultuous, abusive relationship.
And Herman is writing a song like, tap your troubles away while the characters are spiraling.
Exactly. There is a massive tonal disconnect. You can't tap dance your way through a drug overdose. The bright, brassy Herman sound clashed with the gritty narrative. The audience just didn't know how to feel.
So the Jerry Herman touch actually worked against the story.
In that specific case, yes. But, and this is why it's a cult classic today, if you listen to the album without watching the depressing plot, The songs are masterpieces.
Songs like Time Heals Everything.
And I Won't Send Roses. They are perfect songs. They just were in the wrong play.
Despite that stumble, we have to mention one statistic from 1969 that just proves his sheer dominance.
Oh, this is a great stat. From February to May 1969, Jerry Herman was the only composer and lyricist in history to have three original productions running on Broadway simultaneously.
Three original shows at the exact same time.
Hello, Dolly, Mame, and Dear World. He effectively owned Broadway.
Unbelievable. So, we move into the 80s. The musical theater landscape has changed again. The British mega musical is coming. Cats, Lavelle Miss. Herman feels a bit like a dinosaur to some people.
He does.
And then he decides to adapt a French play called La Cage aux Folles.
1983. And we have to really set the context here because looking back from today, La Cage looks like a fun drag romp.
Oh, buddy.
Right. But in 1983, the atmosphere was poisonous.
This is the height of the AIDS epidemic.
The gay plague, as the headlines are calling it then. Gay men were being vilified, feared, ostracized. The news was filled with images of men wasting away in hospitals. It was incredibly bleak.
And the artistic response from the gay community at the time was mostly anger, right? Like Larry Kramer's The Normal Heart, screaming for attention, demanding action.
Rightly so. But Herman did the exact opposite. He put a middle-aged gay couple, Georges and Albin, center stage. They run a drag club in St. Tropez, and he gave them the full, glitzy Hello, Dolly treatment.
That seems counterintuitive. Was he ignoring the reality? Was he trying to bury the tragedy under feathers?
No, he was being highly strategic. He called it a risk, but it was more of a gamble on humanity.
Oh, so.
He was terrified during the Boston tryout. He famously said, quote, "A man singing a love song to another man, I didn't know whether or not they'd throw stones."
He genuinely thought the audience might attack the stage.
The fear was real, but his strategy was basically a Trojan horse. He used the comfort of the old-fashioned musical, the hummable tunes, the costumes, a comedy, to disarm a conservative audience. If he had written a gritty, realistic drama about gay life, middle America wouldn't have come. But they came for the drag queens, and they stayed for the family story.
Because at its core, it's just a story about two parents trying to raise a son whose fiancé has very conservative parents.
Exactly. When the audience gave it a standing ovation in Boston, Herman realized they've bought the characters. He essentially tricked them into empathy.
And he gave his the anthem, "I Am What I Am."
Which became a global gay pride anthem, recorded by Gloria Gaynor. But in the context of the show, it's not a disco party song. It's a demand for dignity. Albin sings it after being told he has to hide who he is for the sake of his son's engagement. It is a moment of pure, defiant pride.
One of the first hit Broadway musicals centered entirely on a gay couple, and it won the Tony for Best Musical.
It helped put gay life in the cultural mainstream. And here is a unique distinction. La Cage aux Folles is the only musical to win the Tony for Best Revival twice.
Twice.
Once in 2005 and again in 2010.
That speaks volumes. It means the show isn't just a period piece. It keeps resonating with new generations.
It proves that the simple message of family and acceptance doesn't age.
Let's weave this back to the man himself. We talked about his design background earlier. While he's having these huge ups and downs on Broadway, he's essentially running a second career, isn't he?
He never stopped being a designer. In the 70s, especially when his theater career cooled off after Mac and Mabel, he took a break. He bought an old firehouse and renovated it.
A firehouse?
Yeah, and it was spectacular enough to be featured in Architectural Digest. Over his life, he decorated and flipped about 36 homes.
36? That seems like more than a side hustle. That's a compulsion.
I think it goes back to that desire for order we discussed. When the critics were being mean or when a show closed early, he could go into a house, knock down a wall, put up a chandelier, and create a perfect environment.
He could control the space. In a way, he couldn't control the critics.
Exactly.
And he certainly couldn't control his health, because the tragedy of the 80s didn't skip him.
No. Herman was diagnosed HIV positive in 1985.
Wow.
And remember, in 1985, that was effectively a death sentence. He watched many of his closest friends and colleagues die.
But he was one of the lucky ones who survived.
He was a survivor in the truest sense. He lived long enough to see the experimental drug therapies actually work. He lived to be 88. Passing away in Miami in 2019.
Alive and well and thriving, to quote one of his own lyrics.
Indeed. And because he lived that long, he got to take the victory lap. He received the Tony for Lifetime Achievement in 2009.
And the Kennedy Center Honors in 2010.
That must have been quite a night. Angela Lansbury introduced him. He was sharing the stage with Oprah Winfrey and Paul McCartney.
It was the culture finally admitting that, hey, maybe this guy with the happy songs was actually a genius all along.
It's amazing to think about the breadth of that journey, from directing campers in the Taconic Mountains to sitting in the Kennedy Center box.
And consistently delivering hits. Just to summarize his legacy here, he was the first composer and lyricist to have three different shows run for more than 1,500 performances each.
Dolly, Mame, and LeCage, that is the 1500 Club, and for a long time he was the only member.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, let's unpack this. We've looked at the bio, the music theory, the cultural impact. What is the big takeaway here for us looking back at Jerry Herman's work?
I think the biggest takeaway from all these sources is that we need to reassess our relationship with joy.
How so?
We tend to equate darkness with depth. We think if something is gritty or cynical, it's somehow more artistic. Herman proved that optimism can be a radical sustaining force.
It's not just stuff.
It's armor. When his mother died, he wrote, "Hello, Dolly," to talk himself back into living. When the AIDS crisis hit, he wrote LeCage to remind his community that life was still worth
He
celebrating.
didn't ignore the darkness.
No, he just chose to light a chandelier in the middle of it.
That is a beautiful way to frame it. He engineered happiness because it was necessary for survival.
Exactly.
So here is a final thought for you listening to Chew On as you go about your day.
Yeah.
We live in an era of prestige drama, of anti-heroes, of deep complexity in our media. But is there something we've lost by undervaluing the simple, hummable song?
It's a great question.
Is it possible that creating a moment of pure, unironic unity where everyone in the room is tapping their foot to the exact same melody is actually the hardest and maybe the most important thing an artist can do?
It's certainly something to sing about.
Thanks for diving deep with us. We'll see you on the next one.